Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment. A few weeks back, Denver had a real treat. There was an iDino presentation at the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. In fact, to prepare for that week, we had interviewed the speaker who came in from Arizona, and that's Dr. Kevin Anderson. He's a molecular biologist. What a thrill. Now, just a few weeks later, we have in studio Dr. Anderson. Kevin, welcome back to Real Science Radio.
Well, thank you for having me back.
So perhaps we could do a little highlight of your presentation that you gave a few weeks ago. But what we really want to talk about is molecular biology. I'd like to ask you a few questions about Adam and Eve, Noah, maybe some of Noah's sons, and even a daughter-in-law maybe, because as creationists, we could learn a lot about those folks from current science.
So this is a three-hour program, right?
Yes, absolutely. And then you and I had also touched on targeted antibodies in the current treatment revolution for cancer.
Yes.
So even that, so three topics.
Yes.
So first, for those who have just tuned in and they've not heard that dinosaur soft tissue is not only being discovered, it's being discovered broadly, and it's being published in major peer-reviewed science journals. Could
yes.
you tell us about that?
Well, the idea would be that if dinosaurs died off 65, 70 million years ago, that you've now had their bones fossilizing for all those tens of millions of years.
They should all be stone.
Oh, yeah, they should all be, right, pure fossil.
Right.
But what has been found over the last several years is that they're not totally fossilized.
Right.
And if you begin to think about that, okay, it's been in the ground for 70 million years, some of them 85 million years,
yeah,
even 100 million years.
Right.
And
Archaeopteryx, 150 million. And it goes up from there.
And it goes up from there.
Yeah.
And yet we're still finding that there is blood vessel tissue, there is muscle tissue, that the bone tissue still is present as far as there's still visible cells, there's still detectable protein that's in this material.
Yeah.
So clearly the bones of the dinosaurs are not fully fossilized. And so that creates the problem of, okay, if you're going to say that they're, you know, 70 million years old, how can it not have fully fossilized? How could it still retain even proteins? And that's obviously a huge challenge for the evolutionary community that requires these millions and millions of years for their processes to work.
Yes.
And it challenges in the entire dating paradigm, because if dinosaur fossils are not as old as they think they are, as they claim they are, then other fossils are likely not nearly as old either. Mm. And therefore, the entire geologic timescale that is so popular, that's such a paradigm, if you will, such a foundation of modern science,
yes,
in the general terms, yeah, now all comes crashing down because you now say, all right, these dates are wrong. Well, if they're wrong, then what are the dates?
The dates are wrong because they're soft tissue in
exactly.
the bone.
Exactly.
Not unlike we have in history that we can date within centuries bones, whether from animals or humans. And we look at those bones and we could find they're mostly deteriorated, desiccated, but we find some proteins, some remnants of blood vessels.
Mm-hmm.
We're finding
mm-hmm.
that in dinosaurs. I'd like to read a list of dinosaurs that have had their soft tissue discovered.
Mm-hmm.
And please, if you would, tell me which of these dinosaurs that you actually have co-authored a paper in a very prestigious science journal
mm-hmm.
on the discovery of soft tissue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so dinosaur soft tissue has been discovered, well, in a mosasaur, but that's not a dinosaur.
Correct.
Right? That's an extinct
but
marine reptile.
It is, but it is one that's dated approximately
80 million years
right,
old. Right.
Yeah.
And Archaeopteryx, but
right.
that's a bird.
Right.
But, okay, dinosaurs. Hadrosaur has given up its soft tissue.
Mm-hmm.
Titanosaur, Ornithomosaur, however you pronounce that. Also, T-Rex and Triceratops.
Yeah, of course, the Triceratops is what we were working on.
Lufengosaurs and others. Okay, so Triceratops.
Triceratops, yes.
And
Mark Armitage.
Mark Armitage went to Montana, the Hell Creek Formation.
Correct. Yes, and we found a brow horn. And this was a very large brow horn.
So a Triceratops has three horns. That's why we call it tri, right?
Right, right, right. The brow horns would be the ones to be back on the top part of the head.
Oh, on the top ridge?
Right, right.
Okay.
And that's where the big horns would be. Oh. And this was a big horn. It was the measured length of what was still intact was almost 4 feet.
Oh, my.
And that probably was not all of it. It looked like it probably had already lost some of the base of it. So it may have originally been at least 4 feet, if not longer. So you put that in proportion to the animal, then you realize this was a very big Triceratops.
Wow.
But what was fascinating for us was it was only about a foot down. It wasn't buried very deep. It was in sandstone. Sandstone's very porous. It had plant roots growing all around. See, so the plant roots come down in there. The rainwater obviously intercalates down. We pull this horn out of the ground and it's still damp. So it's not in some kind of dry, you know, nice, pristine, very, very good preservation condition.
It's not frozen
no,
in the
it's
middle
not
of a glacier.
Frozen in the middle of a glacier. No. Absolutely not. It's only a foot down in sandstone, so it's getting exposed to rain, it's getting exposed to temperature fluctuations, it's getting exposed to plant material, it's getting exposed to microbes. All of those things would be conditions that would accelerate tissue decay, protein decay.
Right.
And yet here we found obvious tissue as part of the bone. They had osteocytes, which look nothing like plant cells. Matter of people would say, well, maybe you just had
that's
plant
from the
cells
roots,
in there, right?
Some kind of contaminant.
Yeah.
It must be bacteria.
Yeah.
But bacteria doesn't form osteocytes, bone cells.
Correct. And bacteria don't look anything like osteocyte bone cells, neither do plant cells. Yeah.
Right.
Neither do human skin cells. You know, it wasn't a matter of you shed skin into the. Yeah. Bone osteocytes are very unique in their structure.
Yeah.
So when you see them, you know them.
Well, and we have photos of what you guys discovered at our website, rsr.org/triceratops. People could see with their own eyes, and that challenges the claim that these things are tens of millions of years old, because these delicate cells would not have survived.
Correct.
And as a side note, there's also carbon-14 in these bones, and that only lasts thousands of years, not millions.
At most, carbon-14 would not be detectable after a million years. So if you're going to say that this fossil is 70 million years old, it'd be what we call carbon dead, which means no carbon-14.
Yeah.
But these fossils are not carbon dead.
Right.
In fact, virtually any dinosaur fossil I've heard about, and certainly there's several in the literature. Right. They all have carbon-14.
And even diamonds we now know have
carbon-14.
So the atheist says, well, that's contamination.
Correct.
Well, a diamond is the hardest natural substance on Earth. How do you get some of the mayonnaise from your sandwich and lunch in the lab? How do you get that inside the diamond to contaminate it?
I mean, I could go with the argument that a fossil would be contaminated because of its exposure. In other words, the processes of contaminating are the same processes that are going to destroy the tissue, which, by the way, they didn't destroy the tissue. Yeah.
Right, right.
But the reason that I reject contamination is because contamination reveals itself in giving you very inconsistent,
erratic results.
That's what contamination does. But what we find is we find very uniform numbers.
Yes.
And it doesn't make any difference what the location is. It doesn't make any difference what the geologic
structure,
whether the bone is found in Jurassic or whether it's found in Cretaceous or whether it's found in even older ones, Cambrian, they all have relatively the same levels of carbon-14, which would not be true if it was contamination. It would not be true if they were all different ages.
And when they have tested the soil, the matrix around the bone, as they go away from the bone, you don't have carbon-14 out there.
Right, right.
You have it in the bone.
Exactly.
So it's not seeping into the bone.
There's been some argument that, of course, ground radiation could form carbon-14,
neutron
which it can't.
Capture.
Right. But it takes so much to do that, that you would literally have to be standing on a uranium field in order to get that much carbon 14 into your fossil. So obviously that is a, but that does bring up another point, and that is that you do have ground radiation. And Jeffrey Botta, who's a geochemist with Scribbs, commented on this, that you can't have tissue surviving in these bones for 100
with
million
radiation,
years.
The radiation decay.
Would have destroyed them. And there's no preservation model out there that addresses that. They don't protect against radiation.
On our list, you mentioned, is it tropism when roots will destroy fossils? There's all these different.
There's all kinds of different.
Right. Hydrolysis.
Right.
And I mean, just temperature fluctuation.
Yes.
Even under the ground, when you have temperature fluctuations, these delicate tissues, they get pulled apart and pushed together as the temperature is increasing, decreasing over annual cycles for 80 million years. It's going to rip apart these delicate
cells. And our horn was only
cells.
A foot down. So it was not like it was buried far enough down that it was going to have some kind of thermal stabilization from the ground. Just a foot, you still get high temperature variation.
So when you have carbon 14, which only lasts, I mean, you said a million years. That's being as gracious.
That's being gracious. Correct. Right.
As could be. If the whole Earth was one chunk of carbon 14,
there'd be nothing left
after
a
million years.
Exactly.
So when you have a little carbon 14 in a bone, it's going to be 50,000 might be a practical upper limit.
They tend
to say
75,000 kind of the rule of thumb. Yeah.
Practical.
Yeah.
But if there is uranium, let's say you've got a dinosaur bone. And it's sitting on a chunk of rock that has a lot of thorium in it, or uranium, like here in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. We have some of that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Well, if you're going to have radioactive decay so that you have some nitrogen 13 in the bone, nitrogen, and it gets hit with a neutron and it captures it, now you have carbon 14. So that's true. You got to account for that.
Right.
Well, the School of Mines is right up the street from us. You know, you get a PhD from the School of Mines and you're set, your career, you're set because you're one of the best in the world. So a geologist who graduated from the School of Mines 20 years ago, he and I were having coffee at a shop just right down the street. And I asked him about this. And he said, in industry, my job is to bombard elements to create isotopes for industry. So we shoot neutrons at all kinds of elements, and we make different isotopes. He said, we can't do carbon because they measure it in barns, how wide the nucleus is. He says that they're just too small. It's very unlikely. So he said, we use carbon to slow up the neutrons. We pass it through carbon to get to our target. So there was a real-world example that if you had a bone encased in uranium, you would not produce enough carbon-14 to justify how much is in these dinosaur bones.
Yeah.
These dinosaur bones are young.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That's exciting.
Right.
Okay, so thank you for giving that presentation.
Absolutely.
Here in Denver to the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. Now, I want to ask you a bit about Adam and Eve.
Okay.
Because.
Never met him.
You never met Adam and Eve.
I don't know. Are you old enough? I don't
know. Adam's birthday is coming up this fall, supposedly.
Okay,
you know,
all right. Yeah, all right.
Possibly. And we have now the study of molecular biology where we could infer what God wrote for the genomes, and especially the mitochondrial DNA of Eve.
Yes.
And then Adam and Noah's sons and daughter-in-laws. Could you talk to us a bit about that? Because that's a thrilling area for not only molecular biology, but especially young Earth creationists.
As we get larger and larger databases from more and more people around the world, we're able to do greater comparisons of just the genetic difference between you and your neighbor, the genetic difference between you and the person, you know, in the next country, the person in the next continent and such, and pool that data together. And what we've been finding then is we can establish human lineages. Not only can we tell that you had ancestors that were Northern European or Southeast Asian, but we can also tell these all begin to cross. There was a paper that came out in Nature several years ago. Now, you have to recognize Nature is a major science publication out of Europe that is anything but creation friendly, anything but God friendly. I mean, if anything, they're the very opposite. And yet in this paper, they admitted that in the year 3000 BC, approximately 3000 BC, all human lineages cross. Now, isn't that amazing? Now, they're not arguing that that's Adam and Eve, obviously, but that would be the type of genetic evidence you would expect to see if Adam and Eve were real. If you did have an original parental pair of a man and a woman, you would expect at some point in time, all human lineages genetic wise would cross. And that's what they reported in a secular journal, 3000 BC. Okay. We also can take mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondrial DNA is the little piece of DNA that's in the mitochondria in the cell. It's separate from the chromosomes that are in the nucleus. You get your mitochondrial DNA typically from your mother. And so we can follow maternal lineages. So we can follow, you would have the same mitochondrial DNA that your mom would have, that her mom would have, that your great, 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 great grandma on your maternal side would have. And we can follow these back. And that's been done. And Rob Carter, who's a good friend of mine, who's also a creationist, he's a creationist. I think they're really exploiting this because the creation model says we expect to find this, and lo and behold, we do. The evolution model does not expect to find this, and so therefore, they don't really look at this very closely. But he has studied mitochondrial DNA enough that he says, and this is published again in the secular literature, he published in the Journal of Nucleic Acids, he has found Eve's,
which is one of the more respected journals
of DNA
in
right.
the peer-reviewed yes. secular
right.
world.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He says he has found Eve's mitochondrial DNA sequence to within just simply six bases of the hundreds and hundreds of bases that are in the mitochondrial DNA. He thinks it got down to where he knows all but six.
So I think that, is it the human mitochondrial DNA around 16,000
16,000 bases.
So
yes.
when God created Adam and Eve on day six, and we don't know how long he thought about this in our genomes, but he's brilliant beyond, he's omnicompetent. And so he thought through how these little energy factories in our cells that are amazing beyond measure. When you look at them, you stand in awe of God, our creator. And you see the absurdity of the claim that this happened by naturalistic materialists. It's absurd. But at any rate, God decided the order of the letters to write Eve's DNA. He decided it. The same way he wrote on stone the Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai, he wrote with his finger, so to speak, he wrote Eve's mitochondrial DNA.
Correct. Yes.
And so Dr. Rob Carter and others are actually uncovering what God wrote to provide energy for the entire human race biologically.
Right. What becomes very significant for us as biblical creationists is that when you look at the sequence of what we're identifying as Eve's mitochondrial DNA sequence, and you then take into account the mutation rate, because all DNA is subject to mutation, and if you look at the mutation rate of mitochondrial DNA that we know of today, in other words, what's the mutation rate today? Not saying it was always the same, obviously, but if you take the mutation rate of today and apply it then, what you come up with is that Eve lived less than 8,000 years ago. And in fact, that's again in the scientific literature in the journal Science. They acknowledge that if we look at mitochondrial DNA as a molecular clock and strictly use just human DNA mutation rate, the mitochondrial, what they call mitochondrial Eve, is only 6,000 years old. They admit that.
Well, that
which
comes
is also
from a
then
quote,
why they reject it. They say, okay, obviously this doesn't work. We can't use this.
That comes from a quote from the journal Science.
Correct.
And Ann Gibbons, a science reporter.
Right. Yep.
And I mean, it's a verbatim quote that when you look at the actual human mutation rate, mitochondrial Eve would have lived a mere 6,000 years ago.
Correct.
And they can't take that.
Correct.
So what they say is, well, they recalibrate by taking the chimpanzee DNA, and they assume we've got to go from the chimp to human, and then they get like 200,000 years.
What it is because we, supposedly by the evolutionary idea of common descent, we share a common ancestor with chimpanzee. So you take into account, you take the chimpanzee mitochondrial DNA and the human mitochondrial DNA, and you supposedly track back to what the sequence of that original ancestor would have been. Now, here becomes one of their problems. They keep changing the date of that ancestor. Mm. So when you keep doing that, then that changes the age of mitochondrial Eve also. But they recognize they have to put that evolutionary fudge factor in there. Otherwise, if you just go on human mutation rate, yeah, you get 6,000 years, and that's not acceptable. But we now also, some further work that's been done, we now also have what we would identify as Noah's daughter-in-law's mitochondrial DNA, because remember, according to Genesis, all humans were wiped off the face of the earth except eight people, and all people would be descendant of Noah's three sons and his three daughter-in-laws. And so again, we would start over, if you will, with three women, and in fact, we now genetically could identify the mitochondrial DNA sequence of these three women, and we can follow the spread of humanity, if you will, based upon the dispersion of those three different mitochondrial families. What we've been able to do is we've been able to reproduce the distribution of these three mitochondrial families to literally account for the distribution of mitochondrial DNA as existed in the world today.
Wow.
So we can generate a human lineage based on a biblical time frame and a biblical concept. Again, creationists are doing this because obviously evolutionists wouldn't do this because it doesn't fit their particular model. It doesn't fit their time frame. It doesn't fit their human history. But it's interesting, they struggle to follow the genetic lineage of humans because, I would argue, it doesn't exist in their as they're predicting it. Mm-hmm. So they struggle to come up with predictions of how to explain, for example, the 6,000 years for mitochondrial Eve.
Well,
they struggle to
yes,
give you a
course.
True lineage for humans.
Kevin, when you mentioned a few minutes ago the paper published just a few years back that it's been only 200 generations. That was the journal Nature, the world's most prestigious science journal. And creationists, I was just looking at the date here. It was back in 2009. Creationists had published, of course, you could calculate it from our biblical worldview.
Yes.
But we've published that there were only around 200 generations since Adam.
Yes.
Approximately.
Uh-huh.
And here comes the journal Nature, like a few years later, publishing that you can account for all of humanity's genetic diversity in only 200 generations.
Exactly.
And that has been now reinforced by other similar studies like the Dutch. They've done a major study. They have found all genetic diversity within Dutch people could be accounted for in only 70 generations. And studies like this are happening around the world, and they're finding out about 5,000 years or so, for example, for Australian Aborigines, and you could account for all their genetic diversity.
If the evolutionary view of human history was true, that shouldn't be the case.
No.
You shouldn't be able
millions
to,
of years
yeah,
of diversity.
You should not be able to account for, as you say, the diversity of all these people groups, of all the populations that are scattered across the earth in this short multi, you know, few thousand year period. Shouldn't be able to do that.
Right.
Exactly. So what that does is that, of course, comes back to that's a biblical worldview. That's a biblical time frame. And so we all the time get told, of course, that they're being the scientists, we're being, you know, the morons,
yeah,
all that
right.
stuff. And yet, constantly, especially
well,
in the world
of— you're
the
moron with a PhD in microbiology.
Well, nobody— it's interesting. I don't get challenged on the genetics. They won't touch that.
Yeah.
They recognize— the people that argue on genetics are not geneticists. That's what I find interesting. They don't know enough to recognize what they don't know. The people that are actually studying this stuff, the people actually know, they stay silent because they know we have big problems here. This is really difficult for us to explain in a Darwinian, you know, neo-Darwinian evolutionary multi-million year time frame. We can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it fits wonderful within the biblical time frame.
So, and then the genetic bottleneck. I mean, we notice that over the years, there'll be a letter to the editor, to the journal Nature, or another journal, and they'll be written tongue-in-cheek by old Earth evolutionists, but they'll say, well, there appears to be a bottleneck in the human genome about 5,000 years ago, and sort of looks like it could be Noah and his kids.
Mm-hmm.
And they publish it in these journals, and they're not serious, but the data is what caused them to publish this. So we affirm God's word from every perspective, whether it's astronomy or geology or now even molecular biology. Everything points to God as our creator, as he revealed in the scriptures.
Yes.
Could we talk a bit now about what I'm calling a cancer treatment revolution using the immune system that God designed?
Yes.
With targeted antibodies. When you were on the show a while back, you said that back in the 60s, there was an attitude back when they thought our bodies were filled with vestigial organs, that it was all leftover junk.
And that
from
a lot,
evolution.
A lot of poor design, poor design.
Poor design. Most of our DNA was junk.
Yeah.
And so they just overlooked our own immune system, assuming it had already been defeated. Let's look down a different path for treating cancer. Like, let's look at radiation.
Yeah, yeah, and chemotherapy.
Yes.
Yes.
And so we went down that path.
It was, we didn't understand the immune system. Yeah, when I took immunology in the late 70s, they were still spending most of the time with question marks. So we don't know, we don't know. So obviously they made the assumptions, well, the immune system just doesn't work. Okay, now we understand more of it and recognize just how powerful it is. What they're doing is antibodies are proteins that are made by immune cells called B cells. They transform what are called plasma cells. They make this protein. The protein has kind of a Y shape to it, and it is made specifically to bind to a certain sequence of protein or a certain structure of like a lipid or a carbohydrate.
Okay.
And that itself is mind-boggling. We could spend three programs on that, just talking about how the B cell knows how to make the antibody to bind to the specific site.
So let's say you have a child and your child is sick,
mm-hmm.
and there was a sponge laying at the bottom of a sink for 2 days, and it's like a factory for mm-hmm. microbes.
Mm-hmm.
And you wash the top of a cup with that sponge, and your child got the bad bacteria. Mm-hmm. Most is apparently beneficial
bacteria. Right.
The vast majority.
Very few are actually pathogenic.
The vast majority.
Yeah.
So now your child is terribly sick.
Yes.
And God gave us an immune system to try to find those microbes and mm-hmm. take them out.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying the way that your antibody is designed physically to attach to whatever that enemy invader is, just that is astounding.
Yes, yes. It's mind-boggling. We still don't understand it. But
is there any relationship to that and something called the binding site? There's binding sites in our DNA,
exactly.
Right?
The antibody, because it's a protein, it has a binding capability to particular binding sites. So it literally will bind onto it, just as proteins would bind onto DNA. This is going to bind onto some molecule on the pathogen or some molecule on the cancer cell. Mm. When the antibody binds, and that's a signal to the immune system that it needs to attack. And in attacking, then it starts bringing in its reserves and all the resources. So what you're having with the cancer, for example, is that the antibodies are being programmed specifically to bind to this particular cancer cell. The immune system is doing that already, but what we're doing medically is we're creating even larger attacking of the antibodies. Mm. So they're enhancing that, essentially.
Oh.
Okay. So that
because
means
they know what the cancer cell looks
exactly,
like.
Exactly.
So you could sort of reverse engineer, or you could engineer what the antibody would have to look like, the shape it would have to take, and the chemical attraction to attach to that cancer cell.
And remember what I told you on the last program, the immune system is, it cannot be defeated if it brings in its full power.
Yeah, that was,
but that
was chilling to
hear
that.
But that would kill you.
Right.
So it has breaks.
Right.
So what we can do by using our God-given intelligence is we can understand how to carefully circumvent certain breaks. Mm. And that's what they're doing with this.
And free it up. Let
yes.
it go.
Yes.
Back in 2011, the National Institutes of Health did a study, and it was how long would it take to mutate a binding site? I don't know if you remember this. They came up with, and now these are basically secular evolutionists. They came up with the answer of 100 million years.
Yes.
It would take 100 million years by a Darwinian process
exactly.
of mutation and natural selection to change a single binding site in the human genome to bind to something else.
Yeah. So if your immune cells were taking 100 million years to figure out how to make a new antibody to bind to this new pathogen or this new cancer cell.
By random variation, it would never happen.
Obviously, you'd be dead before it even started.
Yeah, and
yes.
The whole species would probably go extinct.
Yes.
But
yes.
God designed the immune system so that it would rapidly mutate, seeking out a way to seek and destroy to find these invaders.
In fact, real quickly, people that are born with compromised immunosystems or maybe no immunosystem at all, that's why they have to stay like the bubble boys. Because for them just to even be exposed to what you and I are exposed to just on a daily basis kills them the next day. That's your immune system. That's your
immune system is keeping us
alive. Because you are exposed to stuff every second of every day that would kill you if you didn't have your immune system.
Well, if you take, we've got microscopes at our home. We are homeschoolers. Mm-hmm. We took a drop of water out of the pond near our house. And it's wild.
Right.
There's an entire world inside that drop of water.
Yes. So you would dare not go swimming in that water with no immune system. Absolutely.
You would die within a day. So for one, this falsifies Darwinian evolution, just this, because these things could never
evolve. The program that made the ability for the immune cells to make antibodies with this specific binding had to evolve by that random process. Some of this random process that can't accomplish anything for 100 million years accomplished this major programming that can do it within just a few days.
Right, yeah. So that when you get a new infection you've never had, you're sick and your body's trying to figure out how to fight it. And once it comes upon the right permutation, could you describe that? The antibodies are going through all these permutations so it could attach. Describe that a little bit more.
It's an elaborate process called antigen presentation. And what happens is that the immune system will take, it has its own chemistry lab, and it will take and it will break down the invading pathogen, be it bacteria, be it a virus. It'll even break down the cancer cell.
Wow.
And it will then take and do a chemical analysis of that, determine what are good molecules that will serve for binding sites for the antibody.
Oh my.
And it will then pass that information on to the B cells. This is stuff that has taken years to understand because it is so complicated.
Yeah.
It's called antigen presentation.
Yeah.
So now the B cell knows, I punch in the computer, if you will, and I program specifically, not taking millions of years, not doing it randomly, but specifically program how I'm going to make this antibody so it will have the binding site for just this one particular molecule, not any other molecule. See, other B cells are making other antibodies against other pathogens and other cancer cells. Now, your immune system, it would appear its primary focus is to kill cancer cells. Killing viruses and killing bacteria seems to be a side issue. Because you get cancer cells in your body all the time. And you have systems in your immune system who their primary focus is cancer cells. They're looking for cells that have properties of cancer cells. And they attack and kill them. What we're doing with things like this antibody therapy and such is we're trying to enhance that attack in a very careful manner so they don't just go on the rampage and kill the whole body. They only kill the cancer cells. We're trying to enhance that. So what you're doing is taking advantage of what the immune system does naturally. We're just trying to help it along, if you will.
Once an antibody has figured out, okay, this is a pathogen, we got to address it, it gets back to its chemical lab and they analyze it. And the way God designed us, your immune system figures out the best way to attack it. Now it's got to produce probably millions of targeted antibodies to go after that
specific one.
Pathogen.
Correct. Yes.
So I can understand conceptually how our technicians in the lab could take antibodies and manipulate them, target them for a certain kind of like leukemia. So I get that. Then I wonder how they multiply it. Does your body end up multiplying it itself, or do they have to multiply it in petri dishes and then inject them to you? I'm not sure about that.
Probably both, but I'm sure what they're doing is they're putting into laboratory settings so you can get very rapid, very massive production.
Right.
Yes.
Wow. So, Dr. Kevin Anderson with Creation Research Society, what a joy to have you in studio.
Well, thank you.
Normally, this would be a radio interview. So what a thrill. We have a minute left. Tell us about the website for your organization, CRS.
Yeah, Creation Research Society. We are the society of scientifically trained biblical creationists. Our website is creationresearch.org. One of our focuses, of course, is doing scientific research, supporting a biblical creation model, publishing on that. So we publish, for example, the Creation Research Society Quarterly. I've recently published a book called Echoes of the Jurassic, which is about the soft tissue issue we were talking about earlier. It's a small book. It's not written to be highly technical.
You can read it in a couple days.
Less than that. You can read it in an afternoon.
I think we sold out at the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship when you guys came out a few weeks ago. So, so exciting. You can get Echoes of the Jurassic and creationresearch.org. Beautiful website. And you could join. You could become a member, either voting or not, if you're
correct,
a scientist.
Yes.
And then you get a free subscription
correct
to the Quarterly.
Correct. Anybody that agrees with our position statement can be a member. You don't have to be a scientist. And here's the big thing I push for membership. If nothing else, if all the other perks and all the other advantages we offer don't quite turn your wheel, shall we say, we know that the evolutionist community keeps track of our membership numbers. Mm. And if they suddenly saw our membership numbers
grow
dramatically,
it would scare them to death. Yeah,
and
right.
I love scaring evolutionists.
Yeah, yeah.
So become a member of the society and scare an evolutionist.
Yeah, that's just great. So thank you. What an honor again, Dr. Kevin Anderson. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Kevin sat in Fred Williams' seat. And for Fred and Real Science Radio, this is Bob Enyart. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.